Okay, so let's continue where we left off. And maybe before we continue, is there any questions or comments about what we did this morning?
Yeah.
Everybody happy with that? Yeah? Okay. I love this kind of stuff. I find it really, really nice. It's kind of core, really core Dhamma things. I find these things really inspiring and great. So please, if you have any questions, just ask any time. I think it's a nice way of doing things, have a bit more a conversation going on there. Okay, so let's continue with the Portalia Sutta, Majjhima 54, and see what the Buddha has to say about these things. Okay, so now we come to the... Actually, I was going to read out another short sutta, so if you turn to page... What page is it? 36? And this is part of the well-known sutta called the Mahanidana Sutta. And this is basically a sutta all about dependent origination. And in that sequence of dependent origination, it has a short sub-sequence which shows how craving, desire, leads to all kind of problems. And that is just what we had a look at in the Portalia Sutta, the idea that you fight over things and you create disharmony because we want the same things in the world. And this kind of draws that out in a sense a little bit. So it says, and so, Ananda, feeling conditions craving, craving conditions seeking, seeking conditions acquisition. Acquisition causes decision-making. Decision-making conditions lustful desire. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Attachment conditions appropriation. Appropriation conditions avarice. Avarice conditions guarding of possessions. And because of guarding of possessions, there arise the taking up of stick and sword. Quarrels, disputes, arguments, strife, abuse, lying, and other evil, unwholesome states, or bad, unwholesome qualities. So we don't really need to analyze this in too much detail, I think, because I think it is fairly clear what is going on. When you crave for things, one of the ways of dealing with craving is to attach, right? We attach to those things that give us pleasurable sensations and these sort of things. So craving is always a cause for attachment. And attachment, of course, is the sense that it is mine, it belongs to me. This is what the idea here of appropriation is all about. It is mine. I have the right of this. I'm supposed to control this. Nobody else should do that. Because of that, then of course, once you have that guarding of your possession, and if other people kind of challenge that, then this kind of thing arises. You argue about things and all of these bad states that arise because of that. That is quite interesting, the way this is actually detailed here in the Mahanidana Sutta, how these things arise. So just to give you a little bit of meat on the bones, that one. So let's just, I don't think we need to say much more about that. Let's go back to the page 34 again and continue with the next simile here. So next simile is as follows. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder, if that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So why are they like a blazing grass torch? And I think there are a number of ways to actually think about this? One of the ways of thinking about this is that, first of all, the blazing grass torch is something which gives you a little bit of happiness. It gives a bit of light so you can find your way in the dark. So it has a purpose. It gives you some degree of happiness. But then if you go against the wind, it doesn't take long before it burns you. The little things, little pieces of grass coming off and then burning you as the wind blows the fire towards you. So this is kind of the idea here, right? You burn up because of that. And I think the idea here is that when you enjoy sensual pleasures, you attach to them. And of course, as soon as you attach to something in this world, it is like asking for suffering. The moment you attach to something, and of course we all attach to things, this is part of the problem. You are saying, please allow me to suffer at that point. Yeah, and why is that? Well, it's because all of the things that we attach to in the world, they will have to depart. They will have to be left behind, right? They will be taken from you at some stage. And then the hurt comes as a consequence of that. And we know that, especially in personal relationships, it is so obvious, right? When somebody close and dear to us passes away, or they get hurt or whatever, it is often very, very painful. And people often grieve for long periods of time sometimes after people pass away. If a husband dies, sometimes the wife dies soon afterwards. If the wife dies, the husband dies soon afterwards. And that's because they can't really live apart anymore. If you live the long life together, then you're so close together that you kind of, you know, when you die, you kind of die together in a sense. So this is the problem with attachment. And this is why whenever we kind of indulge in that sensual world, attachment is always going to be a consequence. Because those things that give us that pleasure that we want, that satisfy the craving, those things we're going to hold on to because they give us that kind of small amount of happiness, I suppose, from a Buddhist perspective, but that they do that anyway. And remember that it is not a matter of choice whether you attach to things in the world. Attachment is part and parcel of what it means to be unawakened. So if you have five khandhas, you have a mind, and you are an ordinary person, you have a sense of self, then part and parcel of having a sense of self is that you're going to attach to things. You have no choice in the matter. Sometimes I hear Buddhists say, oh, I mustn't attach so much because I want to be a good Buddhist. But it doesn't work like that. You can't just choose not to attach, because the sense of self is really the thing that does the attaching. Why is that? Well, the reason is because the sense of self means a degree of identity, right? I am certain things. I have certain qualities. And part of that identity is the ownership of those qualities. Sense of self and ownership goes together. At the very least, the ownership of the mental qualities you have. But it also extends to ownership in other things in the world. Relationships, all the physical things, material things of the world are part of that. So all of these things are, in a sense, an extension of your identity, of who you are. And because that is part of your identity, you attach to these things, right? You haven't got any choice. If you really think it is about you and who you are as a person, then your very identity, your very sense of self is challenged if these things are taken away. This is yours. You want to control it. It's part of who you are. How attachments arise and why we attach to these things. So wherever there is a sense of self, there must be attachment. So one of the things you can argue on the Buddhist path is the idea that we need to attach in a skillful way. Don't have much choice as far as attachment is concerned, so we need to learn to attach in a skillful way. So attach to things that attach a little bit to the five precepts, attach a little bit to doing a bit of meditation practice, attach to being kind and generous. And if attached to those skillful things, then the bad attachments in the world, the ones that lead to suffering, tend to decline as a consequence. And then you move up the ladder of attachment until one day all attachments have disappeared. So this is one reason why This is a problem, right? That we, as soon as you pick up that grass torch, as soon as you pick up, hold on, grasp onto something, you attach to something, you are basically asking for suffering at that point. But there are also other problems with this, and that, of course, one of the problems here is also the fact that whenever you attach to some kind of object, you're also increasing your craving, right? Every time we crave, we're kind of perpetuating this force inside of us that desires and craves more. And of course, the point here is that the very fact of craving, the very experience of craving, is really a state of suffering. Sometimes we don't see that. We are perhaps pursuing happiness in the world, pursuing things that we think are important. And then we forget that actually the very feeling of craving is a craving of, first of all, it's restless, right, when you crave things. There's a sense of agitation inside of you. There's a sense of lack, a sense of not being fulfilled. Craving means that you're trying to find that fulfillment somewhere else. There's a sense of emptiness inside of you, something missing inside. And all of these things are part and parcel of that craving. But also, so craving, by its very nature, if you look at it carefully, instead of focusing on the object, you feel what it feels like, you will see craving, by its very nature, is a painful experience. It is suffering in its very nature. So, there you are. These are some ways of considering these similes. Some of these similes are often very rich in their implications. There are many different ways of looking at these things. So what I'm doing here is really just giving you some suggestions. And then if you can think of other ways in which these are true, then please do so, because they're also often very deep and deep in meaning. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. Householders, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain, and two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or deadly suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures or sensual objects have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So there you are, charcoal pit, right? It's pretty very strong simile for the idea of sensual pleasures. And it's very hard to kind of conceive these things, because most of the sensual objects that we have in our life, we love them, right? Our nice car, nice relationships, nice things that we have. Oh, so nice. And the Buddha says, no, charcoal pit, says the Buddha, not so nice. It's a big gap, right, between how we perceive things and what the Buddha says they are. Some of these things, you almost have to take them, you have to take them to some extent on board, on faith, because it's just so hard to recognize these things. So to understand this, why this is the case, I'm going to read you out another bit from another sutta, which kind of explains how this works, how this is possible at all. And this is the sutta, back to page 36 again, to Magandhya, Majjhima Nikaya 75. It's a very nice sutta on the problems of sensual pleasures and sensual objects in the world. And this is the Buddha speaking to this wanderer called Magandhya, and it seems that he is one of these wanderers who enjoys sensual pleasure, and he has this philosophy of enjoying sensual pleasures is the highest happiness. And then the Buddha is kind of saying, well, you know, there are some drawbacks as well. And so this is what the Buddha has to say to Magandhya. So suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. So cauterizing means that he's burning his body, right, over burning charcoal pit. That's what it means. And the reason he does that is because of the incredible itchiness of the wounds. The wounds are really, really itchy, and all worms and all kind of stuff. So it's really kind of disgusting, the whole thing here. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a physician, a doctor, to see him. The doctor would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine, the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then two strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gautama, why is that? Because that fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. What do you think, Magandhya? Is it only now that that fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching? Or previously too was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? Master Gautama, that fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching. And previously too that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. For when that man was a leper, with sores and blister on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. So too, Magandhya, in the past, sensual pleasures were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future too, sensual pleasures will be hot to touch, hot and scorching. And now at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. But these beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by the craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with a fever for sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. Thus, those sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch. They acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. So there you are. It's a very, very, very powerful simile, and it's very hard to kind of get one's mind fully around this. Of course, you can approach an understanding when you meditate a little bit and you get some peace and quiet in your mind, and you compare that to the mind that is fully devoured by craving and desires and all of these kind of things, then you start to get some idea what the Buddha is talking about here. You understand that the peaceful mind is actually far superior to the mind that is restless and agitated and running around and is hot, right? The idea of heat here is precisely the idea of craving. The mind is hot inside because of the craving, being driven around, slave to craving, and the heat inside is that feeling of desire and craving when it becomes quite stronger. So he's basically what he's comparing here is that the heat of the charcoal pit is the same kind of heat that you feel when the mind is kind of driven by these cravings and desires. And it's very hard to fully understand and compare the distinction between craving and a fully peaceful mind until you actually move out of craving entirely. And when you have left craving entirely behind, and all you have left is samadhi and peace and stillness in the mind, only then is it possible to make this kind of comparison. And only then do you understand where real happiness and real pleasure actually lies on the Buddhist path. So this is the thing. So again, it's good to kind of keep that just in mind, and just remember that what the Buddha teaches about these things, and just I guess have some degree of confidence that if the Buddha says so, well then there probably is some truth to this. So even if it's hard to fully grasp, at the very least to have it at the back of your mind as something that is quite possibly is true because the Buddha actually says so. Anyway, so that is how this craving, sensual desire come to be compared to a charcoal pit. And that is what the Buddha called. This is the most powerful simile of them all in terms of showing the kind of suffering that is inherently part of sensual pleasures. Okay, so let us go on to the next one. And then this is about dreams. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes. And on waking, he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sense pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here we have the simile of the dream, right? Which is, I think, is quite nice, and I think this is one that is actually quite easy to understand why sensual pleasures are like a dream. We often dream about sensual pleasures, we think about life, we think about what it is going to be like when we get that relationship, when we get that car, when we get that house, and we have this idea of the kind of perfect relationship and these kind of things. And of course, relationships are never that perfect. And it's not necessarily because of the other person or because of ourselves. It's just that there is kind of inherent friction when you have two people living together with slightly different ideas, going slightly different ways and all kind of things. Just inherent that there is going to be a little bit of friction usually with these things. So remember that very often the dreams and the ideas that we have, especially when you're young and you kind of fall in love with somebody and you have these ideas about what these things are going to be like, right? And it's just so unrealistic sometimes, so completely out of reality. And the reality often is very, very different from these things. And this is part of the problem here. And a lot of people, they're always chasing around new relationships, always looking for that. There's a nice story which Ajahn Brahm tells, and he apparently heard it from Ajahn Jagaro. Ajahn Jagaro was the previous abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery. It's over 20 years ago now. And he apparently told this story. And this was a Nasruddin. You know, have you heard about Nasruddin? Yeah. This was a Nasruddin story. Nasruddin was this kind of sage, Islamic sage, Muslim sage, or kind of funny man as well, but kind of sagely funny man in a sense. And Nasruddin, it was one story where this man is sitting there. I can't remember which person Nasruddin was, but there was a man who was eating, sitting under a tree and had this big bag of chilies. Right? And then he would take out a chili and he would start eating it. Right? Eating one, finished with that chili. Takes a second one, eats a second chili. Sweat is pouring down. Snot is coming out of his mouth. You know what it is? Out of his nose, rather. You know what it's like when you eat too much chili. It's really, really hot. And then the third one, and it keeps on going like this. And this other man comes along and he says, "What are you doing? What, how come you're eating just raw chilies like that? Are you mad or something? It's crazy what you're doing." And then the man with the chilies, he replies, "I'm looking for the sweet one." There is no sweet chili, right? Chilies are not sweet by definition. That's why they are chilies. And this is like life in a nutshell. This is like the dreams we have. We're looking for the sweet relationship. We're looking for the sweet, sense pleasure, ultimate sense pleasure. But ultimately, we keep on going. And in the end, there is no final search for these kind of things. Every life, every time, we go back to the basics and we look for the same thing. And every time, sometimes they are more satisfactory. And sometimes relationships can be reasonably good. But then we die, right? And then when you die, of course, that's when you get the suffering of a relationship that was good. And if it isn't so good, well, then you're happy maybe when you die. But it wasn't really worth it in the first place, right? So either way, you kind of lose out. And then you die, and then you get reborn, and then the same thing again, and again, and again, and again, and again. Looking for the sweet chili, and the sweet chili never actually appears. It's quite a nice metaphor for our life in samsara, looking for the sweet chili here, and not actually finding it, and eventually just finding more suffering here. So notice that. I noticed that in my own life when I was young, going to university, and I always had ideas about kind of what kind of girlfriend I was going to have, what kind of job I was going to have, right? Little did I know I was going to end up like this eventually, but my ideas were very, very different when I was young at university than what they are now. It's very kind of different ideas about my career and about where I was going to live and all of these kind of things. And like most young people, I was probably quite conceited. I can barely think back now. Yeah, very clearly, I was quite conceited about myself and what I was going to do and the kind of big things I was going to achieve in life. And, of course, things turned out extremely differently from what I thought at that time. So you can see what complete waste of time and how unrealistic these dreams actually are. And then as we dream, right, we realize that our dreams are unrealistic. So we change them a little bit, right? We kind of downgrade them a little bit because we were a little bit too conceited before. Downgrade a little bit. Then those new dreams are unrealistic. And we downgrade those. And the new dreams are unrealistic until eventually we die. And then we start dreaming afresh again, and so it goes on and on and on. Reality is always different from the ideas. Reality never matches with actually the things, how we think things are going to be. We always overestimate the happiness, always underestimate the suffering of things. Notice that in your mind when you think about the future. Notice what the future looks like, and then see the reality when it actually comes. It never really matches up. Right? And this is one of those very interesting things. It is always this unrealistic dream. Like it says here, in the dream, you see the lovely parks, the lovely meadows, right? This is what the dream is all about. Oh, it's all so beautiful. And then when you wake up one day, you get there, it's all gone. There is nothing there here. So the Buddhist teaching is pretty bleak, isn't it? Kind of harsh reality. Whoa, I'm not sure if I want to see this reality. It's a little bit too much. Anyway, so let's move on to the next one. This is one of my favorite ones. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage and fine jeweled earrings, and proceeded and surrounded by those goods, he went to the marketplace. Then people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here we have this person who borrows things, right? And in those days, you didn't have to borrow much before you were considered rich. If you had a nice carriage and some nice earrings, that was enough, and people considered you rich already. It was quite easy in those days. These days, it's a bit more complicated than that. But the point here is that, of course, everything we own in our life are ultimately borrowed goods. This is what this is saying. Everything we own, everything that we have, ultimately is borrowed, and it has to be given back. And at the very latest, it has to be given back when you die. Right? So the more, all the stuff that we think is ours, all the things that we attach to in this life, all of these things that we are so fond of, you're going to have to give it back. Often, you have to give it back before you die, because somebody comes and you lose it, or somebody burgles it, or something happens to these things. But at the very latest, you have to give it up when you die. And that, of course, is very interesting, and also is worthwhile considering the sort of things that we're talking about here. Very obviously, we're talking about all the things that we own, all our material possessions, all has to go, absolutely everything. Your house, where you live, all your possessions, your clothes, even the most dearest possession has to be left behind. And it's interesting, isn't it? I sometimes hear about some of these funerals. I like the kind of Chinese funerals that I hear about, you know, that kind of where they have little paper things there. And they burn, it's kind of sweet, isn't it, in a sense? They burn a little paper car, a little paper house. Is that correct? Do they do that sometimes? Yeah? And it's kind of nice because you can see what is going on there, what they are trying to do. They're trying to take the material possessions with them into the next life. That's what they're trying to do. And it's not just the Chinese culture. This is across all cultures around the world. You find similar kind of ceremonies to try desperately to take your possessions in this life and bring them with you after you die. I know in my own, in Norway, in the ancient Viking culture, it was very much the same kind of thing. In the Viking culture, the chieftain who had a big Viking ship, when he died, he was put inside the boat with all his possessions, sometimes also the wives, right? It's really cruel, right? You put all the wives in there. They're not dead yet, but that doesn't matter. Put all the wives in there, and then you light the whole thing up, and you burn it up out in the ocean. And the idea is, again, you want to have your wives also in your next life, right? Don't want to give them up now. So take all the wives in there, and all your possessions, burn everything up, and then maybe the smoke goes to heaven or something. And then when the smoke goes to heaven, then you can kind of enjoy it up there afterwards. So this is a very common idea, this idea, and it's very obvious that we have spent so much time in this life, right? Working hard, making money, buying all these beautiful possessions. You're not going to give it up when you die. There's no way. You want to take it with you, right? So it's better than to pretend we're going to burn a few paper cars and whatever, and that somehow that nice BMW is going to go with us to heaven. But it doesn't work that way, right? Just because you get a bit of smoke, it doesn't mean the smoke kind of takes these things to heaven. It's just a kind of, it's a desperate way of trying to salvage something which is unsalvageable. That is basically what's going on there. But that's only the possessions. That's only one thing. It gets far worse than that. Because, of course, the other thing that we have to give up is all our friends, all our acquaintances, all our family members, right? And often the deepest attachments that we have are not to things in life, but they are to other people. All of that has to go when you come to the end of your life. Even more, you have to give up your physical body, right? The physical body that we look after so much, we dress it nicely, we go to the gym, we kind of use, you know, all kind of makeup and jewelry and what have you to make it look nice, right? So much effort into this blooming body. And in the end, it has to go. It ends up in a little pile of ash after the crematorium. That's what it ends up, all that kind of, all that hard work you put into this body. But it goes, it's even more than that. Because some of the things that we have to give up are actually psychological things. If you think about it, a lot of our psychological makeup, our identity is tied to the things of this world. Right, you have an education, and education is tied to the kind of university you went to. You have a social position, all tied to your social position in this world. You have a certain success, maybe as a business person, and you have that career, it's tied to this world. You have a position within a family, your type of family member is tied to this world. So much of our identity, so much of who we are psychologically is also tied to this world. And that, of course, also has to go when you die, right? There is so much that we have to leave behind, so much stuff that is borrowed goods, and this is the problem. So the question then arises, when we know that all of these things have to be given up when we die, the question is, how much time are we going to invest in borrowed goods? How much of our resources, our effort, our work are we going to do into stuff that we know we're going to have to give up at the very latest when we die, quite likely before that? A lot of these things disappear before. Relationships come and go, wealth comes and goes, all these kind of things, right? It's always uncertain, these things. So how much time are you going to invest in things that you have to give up very, very soon? Our life is so short. We get born here. We die over there. Are you going to invest everything in this tiny little lifespan? And this is where this whole idea of rebirth becomes so incredibly important. Because instead of looking at life as this tiny little thing, getting born here, dying over there, suddenly it kind of expands out, opens up into this enormous vista of life after life after life, of carrying on for a very long time into the future. And what happens there, this is what I'd like to say, what happens there is when you see that, your investment strategy becomes different. You start investing in a different way because your vision of reality is very different. Right? So are you ready to change your investment strategy? Don't go down to your local accountant and ask them about this because they won't not understand this investment strategy at all. This is where you have to take charge yourself. So what you do then is instead of thinking about this tiny life, you start to understand, if I just focus on this life and disregard everything else, I might be happy for a very short time and then miserable for all the other time. But really what we should do instead is to have a strategy whereby happiness is actually spread out over this whole horizon, long, long time into the future. Then you have a wise investment strategy. It's like the person when they are young, they start to save a little bit for when they become pensioners, instead of forgetting about when you retire and then just becoming really poor when you become old, right? That is a very, very short-sighted way of living your life. In the same way, we look long-term also when it comes to our existence beyond this life as well. So what does that mean? And what it means, of course, is that instead of investing all our time into the things that belong to this world, we invest our time in the things that belong to this larger perspective. What are those things? It is the quality of our mind that we're investing in. Yeah? And the quality of our mind means all those things that we do on the spiritual path. The kindness, the ethics, the compassion, the generosity, the understanding, the peace that we build up during this life, all of that is the investment in the mind. And that mind is the only thing that you carry with you after you die and into the future. Everything else has to go, but those qualities, that karma, if you like, that is what you take with you into the future life. Yeah, so the whole thing just changes. And when people sometimes say it doesn't really matter if you believe in rebirth or not, I say it's madness to think that. It changes your entire outlook. The way you live becomes completely different. Your willingness to invest differently, to live in a different way, becomes massively, changes enormously because of that idea of rebirth. So I say it has an enormous effect on how we live. And the more you kind of get into that idea, the more you actually change your strategy. Now, one of the important things here is that it doesn't mean that we necessarily do different things in life. It doesn't mean that we quit our job or we change our relationship or anything like that. It's not what we do so much in this world that matters. It is how we do things that is important, right? You can work almost any kind of job. We can have almost any kind of relationship. You can do all sorts of stuff, but it's how you do these things that really matters. And if you do things in your life with kindness, with care, with all of the right qualities, and anything you do can become a source for long-term happiness, a long, long time into the future, a long time after you pass away even. So that is what it is. The change here is a change from how we live, not so much what we do, but how we live our lives. And we focus more on the goodness of the heart, the kindness, all the qualities of the heart, rather than so much on the external things. So there's a gradual movement there away from what really matters in life. And what that means is that if you don't have a magnificent business career and a remarkable kind of, you know, relationship and all of these things, if that doesn't really turn out the way you thought it would, and for the vast majority of people it doesn't turn out that way, it doesn't matter so much because you have another happiness, the internal happiness, the happiness that comes from the spiritual path, and you realize actually you have something far more valuable. It is both more valuable in this life, and of course after death, then it is the only thing which has any value. Okay, anyway, so that is the idea of the borrowed goods, which I find it a very nice way of thinking about life. Now, let us turn to another sutta, another little sutta, a bit further back, page 37, the Samiddhi Sutta. This is one of the suttas I like. It's also about sensuality. And it goes as follows. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in the hot springs park. Then the Venerable Samiddhi, having risen at the first flush of dawn, went to the hot springs to bathe. Having bathed in the hot springs and come back out, he stood in one robe drying his limbs. Right, for those of you who have been to India, you may remember the hot springs in Rajagaha. I don't know if you remember them, but it's very... remember them, hot springs in Rajagaha? Anyone? No? When you go there, it's remarkable, because you read about these things in the suttas. But of course, if you go there today, the hot springs are still there. And there are still people bathing in those hot springs, right? 2,500 years later on. One of those amazing things. Today, it's a bit more made up. They look like a proper bathing place. But it is still basically the same thing 2,500 years later. As I was saying before, in India, there are many things just carrying on and carrying on almost endlessly here. Anyway, so this is what happened at this hot springs with the Venerable Samiddhi. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain Devata of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire hot springs, approached the Venerable Samiddhi. Having approached, she stood in the air and addressed the Venerable Samiddhi in verse. Without having enjoyed, you seek alms, Bhikkhu. You don't seek alms after you've enjoyed. First enjoy, Bhikkhu, then seek alms. Don't let the time pass you by. I do not know what the time might be. The time is hidden and cannot be seen. Hence, without enjoying, I seek alms. Don't let the time pass me by. Then that Devata alighted on the earth and said to the Venerable Samiddhi, you have gone forth while young, Bhikkhu, a lad with black hair, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, without having dallied, in other words, enjoyed with sensual pleasures. Enjoy human sensual pleasures, Bhikkhu. Do not abandon what is directly visible in order to pursue what takes time. I have not abandoned what is directly visible, friend, in order to pursue what takes time. I have abandoned what takes time in order to pursue what is directly visible. For the Blessed One, friend, has stated that sensual pleasures are time-consuming, full of suffering, full of despair, and that the danger in them is still greater. While this Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. So, here we have this idea, right? You can see they have the exact opposite ideas about sensual pleasures and the Dhamma. The Devata thinks, well, you know, why are you practicing this life as a bhikkhu, seeking some kind of distant happiness, right, as a bhikkhu, somewhere down the line, when sensual pleasures are available right here? Find yourself a nice wife, get a nice little house, and then enjoy the worldly pleasures. Why wait? It's all available. No need to kind of wait for the happiness of being a monk. And then the monk says the exact opposite. He says that, no, it's the other way around. It's the happiness of the Dhamma that is directly visible, not the happiness of sensual pleasures. And then the question arises, well, who is right in this particular case? And you don't get any bonus points for saying that the monk is right, right? Because it's kind of obvious, because you know how the Dhamma works. But I remember asking this crowd, this was in Indonesia, and there was a lot of some young people there. There was a young man sitting on the front bench, right? And I asked this question, who is right, the Devata or the monk? And this young man said, yeah, the Devata is right. And he was just being honest, right? Because that is what it feels like. This is what it seems like in the world. Sensual pleasures are immediately available. You just go down to the local restaurant, as somebody was saying in the questions the other day, and you have a nice meal. And you search out all these nice restaurants and you have all of these things. It's right there available. Who, you know, the Dhamma, on the other hand, you sit down in meditation, nodding away, being tired, thinking, oh, Dhamma is so hard, there's no happiness in this Dhamma. So why? What is going on here? It looks like the Devata is right, so how come the monk can have the exact opposite ideas? What is happening here? And of course, what is happening? We have just seen some of the similes of the Buddha. What is happening is that sensual pleasures are always heavily involved with craving and desires. And craving and desires are always about the future. It is very rare that we actually really enjoy sensual pleasures fully in the present moment. Almost always are we going on to something else. Almost always are we slightly distracted. Almost always is there some craving and desire even while we are enjoying these things, let alone when we're just thinking about them and moving towards them. So sensual desires are very much like this dream we were talking about before. The dream of craving, the dream of getting somewhere else, the dream of the next meal, right? The dream of the next cup of coffee, which I'm going to have soon. These are the sensual pleasures, right? They're always this moving forward. It's never in the present moment, always somewhere in the future. That is the Dhamma view of things, and it's so different from the ordinary view that people have. They think the Dhamma is far away. So what about the Dhamma? Why is it that the Dhamma is directly visible? What does that mean? Well, of course, it means, first of all, that Nibbana is something you can experience in this life. But still, that seems kind of far away, right? Okay, maybe in theory that's right, but it's not something that we, most of us, can feel right here and right now. But what we can feel, that if you turn your mind around on this particular moment, from being angry, for example, just changing your perception of a certain person, bang, right on the spot, you will feel the consequences of that ability of turning your mind around. If you, at this particular moment, decide to be generous towards somebody, and with your openness of the heart, you give something in a nice way to some other person, right there on the spot, you will experience that piti, that happiness that comes from being generous here and now. So if you are able to tap into the Dhamma, if you are able to turn your mind around in the way the Buddha suggests, you will actually experience the happiness of the Dhamma right here, right now. If you make a decision, I want to be kind to other beings, straight away in your heart, you will feel a little better about yourself. And this is what it means, that the Dhamma is visible here and now. If we practice it in the right way, we're able to tap into these things, you will experience the happiness as well. So that is that Samiddhi Sutta. I love that little sutta because it is kind of, it's sort of a little bit counterintuitive. And it goes against the kind of ordinary stream of things in the world. But it has a kind of nice point to it, I think. Okay, so let's go back to the Potalya Sutta again and have a look at the very last simile here. And so this simile is as follows. Householder, suppose there were a dense grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and he entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. Then a second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and taking a sharp axe. And he too entered the grove, saw that tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. What do you think, householder, if that first man who had climbed the tree doesn't come down quickly, when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body, so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have this man. He enters the dense grove not far from some village or town. And the dense grove is like the world of sensual pleasures. It's probably a bit like walking down into downtown KL, right? And looking at all the shopping malls and all the shops and whatever. Or even worse, something like Orchard Street in Singapore, you know, where there's kind of ridiculously amount of expensive stuff everywhere. And the world is a bit like this these days, right? You walk around in this concrete jungle, and here it is the real jungle, so similar kind of thing. And as you do that, you're looking up into the trees, looking up into the buildings, seeing all these shops, all this, you know, Italian designer stuff and what have you in these shops, and it all looks really fancy and amazing. And you're wandering around, and then you come to a tree that is full of fruit, full of all these beautiful sensual pleasures, and you could do with some of those sensual pleasures, right? I don't know if any of you here are into that. You're all very good practicing Buddhists, but I guess everyone sometimes is a little bit into these things. I remember when I was young, I was sometimes into this kind of stuff, and now it all seems very silly, but at the time it kind of seemed like the right thing to do. So then you finally come to this place where you see some nice sensual pleasures. And what do? You then climb that tree. And I would say that is a simile for attachment. Now you're attaching onto it. And you're getting into those fruit. You start eating the fruit in that tree as you climb up that tree. And of course that eating of the fruit, that is indulging in sensual pleasures, right? And that tree is maybe full of nice, sweet mangoes. Everybody likes mangoes, right? And you just, oh, these mangoes are so nice, such a wonderful mangoes. And as you eat those mangoes, you forget about reality. You are intoxicated by those mangoes. You know what it's like, right? When you eat a really nice mango, you can't really think of anything else because the mango is so nice. The mango occupies your entire mind, right? This is how it works when you get a nice mango. And it is a bit, little bit like that with sensual pleasures in the world. We are intoxicated by these things. And it is just like being intoxicated by drink, by alcohol. If you are intoxicated by alcohol, you don't really know anymore what is right and what is wrong. You get the priorities all wrong. And that is why we start doing bad things when we are intoxicated by alcohol. We forget what is right. We forget what is inappropriate. Not everybody does that. Many, many people do that when they get drunk. But the problem is that in Buddhism, intoxication by alcohol is only one kind of intoxication. There are many ways of being intoxicated. And we will see later on, one of these intoxications is like intoxicated by life. The fact that, yeah, I'm alive, I can do whatever I want, right? Now is a chance to mess around and do silly things. And you forget that one day you're going to die. And then one day when you finally die, you regret that you wasted a lifetime by being intoxicated, by being alive. So many things can be regarded as intoxications on the Buddhist path. And one of the intoxications is when we kind of give ourselves over to sensual pleasures and we become heedless. We don't know what we're doing anymore. We're just, enjoying sensual pleasures in a kind of stupor. And then one day what happens? As we are enjoying that, as we are intoxicated, then one day another man comes with an axe and he's going to chop down that tree. And while we're sitting enjoying those sensual pleasures, suddenly the whole thing comes crashing down. And that, of course, is a metaphor for death. In the middle of things, while you are intoxicated by the sensual pleasures, suddenly death comes and carries you away. I wasn't supposed to die yet. It's too early. I'm only 75. I want to become at least 80. Right? I'm only 55, right? Oh, I should become at least 80 years old. It's unfair. I'm only 100. I wanted to be 102. This is how people think. People are never ready to die. Death is always supposed to be a little bit later. Even if you're 115, at least you're supposed to be 115 and 2 days before you die. Always looking towards something else. Always looking towards the future. And this is the problem here. So we need to grasp these things straight away so we can start living in the right way now rather than being intoxicated by these things. And then this is kind of avoided. So this, I think, is the metaphor here found in this last one, is this idea of being intoxicated and not actually being able to see what is right and what is wrong. And as part of this, one of the nice kind of similes that you may have heard that Ajahn Brahm sometimes teaches, you find that in his book, in the opening, The Door of Your Heart, he talks about the time when he went to the Yucatan Peninsula in Guatemala. That's in Mexico, isn't it? I think it's in Mexico, that's right. Have you heard, you know that story? No, not my story? Okay, so this is the story where he goes to, this was back in the 1960s, I think, so it's a long time ago, and before these places were really touristified. There was no tourists around in these days. And Ajahn Brahm was at that time, he probably was at Cambridge University or something like that, so he used the summer holidays to go traveling around the world. And he went to India, he went to Norway once on one of his trips, and he went to Mexico, to the Yucatan Peninsula, because he had read about these ancient Mayan pyramids that exist down there, right? These remarkable structures found in the jungle of the Yucatan Peninsula. So he goes there, and of course, when he comes there, it's all jungle. This is in the tropics. Really, really bad jungle. That time was before the tourists would come to this part of the world, so it was very hard to get around. So we'd kind of climb onto an old lorry to get a hike, move down in roughly the right direction, get onto a boat, right, go down a river with kind of big canopies over you or at all times. And you could never really see very far ahead of yourself. You were always blinded because the jungle was so thick in this particular case, in this particular place. And then one day, after two or three days traveling through the jungle in this way, finally he arrives at these pyramids. Right? And because this is before the tourists came there, there is no guards around, there's no entrance fee or anything like that. And because there's no guard entrance fee, you can just walk straight up these ancient structures. If you go there now, it's kind of, you know, you have to be very careful, you can't go many places. But in those days, there was nothing like that. So he walks up this pyramid. And then, as he walks up the pyramid, there comes a point when he clears the canopy of the forest. He goes above the canopy, and eventually he goes up quite a bit above the canopy, and then he can see the jungle beneath, around him. And from that viewpoint on top, he can see the little pathways where the truck was driving. He can see the little rivers where the boat he was going on was going. He can see the little pathways in the jungle. And far away, he can see the horizon, right? Looking far away, and maybe even seeing the ocean in the distance, because the ocean isn't that far away in this particular place. And he said, this is exactly what you experience in samadhi, the opposite of what you are experiencing here. Here you are kind of engulfed in the jungle, climbing the trees in the jungle, and then one day you find this ancient pyramid, and this ancient pyramid is called Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, the pyramid of breathing. And then as you climb the pyramid of breathing, eventually you reach the apex of this pyramid, and that is called samadhi. For the first time in your life, you are above the jungle of sensual pleasures. And because you are above the jungle of sensual pleasures for the very first time in your life, now, only now, can you understand what is going on. Because now you have the overview, you have the oversight, you can see what is down there, and you can see what it is like to be out of that jungle. Yeah, and this is why it is so hard for us to comprehend this whole problem of, you know, of sensual desire. Yeah, yeah, charcoal pit, sure, it is like a charcoal pit. Yeah, I don't, you know, maybe a little bit, but not quite. I mean, the Buddha must be exaggerating, right? But basically we don't know, because we are so immersed in these kind of things. And then one day you go above all of these things, and then you look down, and only then can you understand what is going on. Now you have the oversight. Now, when you have emerged from these things and you look down upon them, can you understand what they are? It's like that simile of the tadpole in water. As long as you are immersed in the water, there's no way you can understand what the water is all about. And then one day you become the frog and you jump out of the water and think, whoa, that is what water was. Now I understand what the water is like. Anyway, so that is just adding another simile, as if there wasn't enough similes already in the sutta. So now we're drowning in similes often. Anyway, I really enjoy these similes. I find them really powerful. I find one of the beautiful things about the Buddha's teaching is that it is not, sometimes it gets a bit theoretical and we talk about theory and all these kind of things. But what to me really brings the Buddha's teaching alive is often the similes and the little stories and the metaphors, right? Often very beautifully done, and they kind of give life to these things. And there are many more similes to come. Are you sure that we should shorten down the day today? Is it a good idea to shorten down the day? Maybe people will complain if we shorten down the day. There's so many nice suttas here, and I think we should have as large number of suttas as possible to really inspire people, you know. So I think we should go back to the old program. Should we try the old program for another day? Is that a good idea, or should we? Yeah. Okay. So let's try it for another day and see what happens. Because it is really enjoyable to read these suttas. Anyway, let's have a break for about 15 minutes, and then we'll see you back again.